I didn't buy it.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the June 18, 2024 regular session of the Island County Board of Health. And are there any additions or changes to the agenda?
I'll second.
Motion made and seconded to approve the agenda. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Is there a motion to approve the minutes from May 21st?
Make that motion.
I'll second it.
Motion made and seconded to approve the minutes from May 21st. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. So the board values the public's input, and this is the time that we set aside to hear from the public on subjects of a health-related nature that are not on our scheduled agenda. All information given is taken under advisement. Unless emergent in nature, no action is taken. To ensure proper recording of comments, please state your name and address clearly into the microphone and limit your comment to 2 minutes. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to make public comment to the Board of Health? Anyone? So we'll move to the screen. Is there anyone online who wishes to make public comment to the Board of Health? Anyone? All right, then we're going to close public comment. Thank you. First item on our agenda is a contract with the health officer. Sean.
Good afternoon. So this is to renew our agreement with Dr. Howard Liebrand, the Island County Public Health Officer, to extend the contract for a period of 5 years from June 30th of 2024 to June 30th of 2029. We're excited to make this recommendation to the Board of Health and continue working with Dr. Liebrand, who has done a great job supporting our teams across public health. Happy to field any questions the board may have about the agreement.
Well, I personally am excited to receive this recommendation. I remember when we were in the middle of the pandemic and he stepped up and was just instrumental in our work during those tough times and present and available for questions offline. Throughout that, he's just been a real asset to this board, and I appreciate his service to us.
Very much so.
And tell you the times I was in my car on the side of the road calling him during those years, and he was always making himself available.
Wow. Thank you. Okay. Motion made.
Second.
Motion made and seconded to approve the contract with Dr. Liebrand. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And we're really, really grateful to Dr. Liebrand for being willing to work with us for years and years to come. The next item is a panel discussion, and I'm really personally very excited about this. I've been looking forward to this conversation with the Island County superintendents to discuss the physical and behavioral health needs of Island County students. And Sean, you are going to moderate this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner Bacon. So it looks like superintendents, we have a few joining us remotely, and I don't see any in the audience here. So we may, we did have confirmation. Superintendent Deborah Rumbach from Stanwood Camino School District was not able to attend, but we'll see if Superintendent Mocha is able to join.
Do you want us to move to the next item on the
move
agenda?
To the next item, the okay. Healthy Youth Survey, and see if that gives some additional time.
Okay, why don't we do that? Yeah, thank you. Are you okay with that? We did approve the agenda. You're okay? Okay, we're going to move to the next item. So the next item on the agenda, just to give us a few more minutes for Dr. Mocha to come, is the Healthy Youth Survey Data and Community Health Assessment, the CHA, presented by Taylor Lawson.
Make sure you can hear her online. That's important.
Thank you all. I need to see you back then.
And I think it was this healthy youth survey data from a year ago or more that got us so concerned. So that led to this conversation with the superintendents to begin with. So this will be a good lead into that conversation.
Yeah, that's right.
Purposes of people listening to this, we're just waiting to bring up the presentations. The board has it in our packet also. If we need to just do that, take that approach. Oh, there you go.
All right. Well, thank you, board, for welcoming me. And actually, yes, it's a great opportunity for us to kind of start a conversation. Reviewing our 2023 results from our Healthy Youth Survey, I do want to preface before we start that this is a very high overview. And also includes Whidbey Island specifically. As we mentioned in previous board meetings, Camino and San Antonio School District provides a different survey for their students. And so we're in the process of kind of nurturing that data sharing and seeing where we can have opportunities for collaboration in the future. So as a overview recap, our Healthy Youth Survey is administered in schools across Whidbey Island to multiple grades. It follows cohorts throughout their time. So it really allows for us to see change over time among the same students if we follow their cohorts throughout school. Some of the topics that are discussed throughout or asked of students throughout the survey include substance use, safety and violence, behaviors, risk and protective factors, home health and health related behaviors.
Before you leave that, do you want questions during or following?
If you don't mind just writing notes and then I can kind of look back on the presentation, that would be really helpful. But if it's something that is about the content that needs clarification for the, you know, for the audience to understand what you presented, that would be really helpful as I'm speaking. So if you have some general questions about the content, I'll share and then afterwards.
This is really about the data set.
Right.
You talked about administered in schools for grades 6, 8, and 10. Was that in our regular schools or were any of our alternative high schools included?
They're in our regular schools, but all of our schools here on the Whidbey Island participate. So key takeaways. There is hope and positivity throughout the data. There are also areas for improvement and ongoing efforts while recognizing the other what's currently happening at the moment. Really thinking about being critical and identifying and addressing gaps, and then bringing in youth voice into the conversation. So things that we can consider in the future. For example, board meeting I went to for Southview Schools had student representatives on the board that spoke about the whole survey, kind of the experience of giving the survey and their interpretation of the results. So I found that really valuable for this conversation. I think it's really helpful to consider in the future. So I've been trying out for presentation's sake on the top of my slides will be the key takeaway from this slide to help folks kind of gather that information more quickly, and then we can talk if you have questions about the content of the slide too. So for this one, we've been tracking participation across years, and in this year in particular, 2023, the survey was administered online. So this is a new opportunity for us to look at if that facilitated participation or if it becomes barrier for students, something to consider as we move forward in time. But as you can see from the percentages, our participation remained about the same, and the sum of our grades decreased just slightly between the 2 years. Next section about the substance use and just a few of the questions. So I want to reiterate that this won't be all of the questions that I'm asking. Some key takeaways from the substance use data include majority of our students, our youth, are, don't use any substances. They're both not using it. But with that in mind, we noticed that alcohol was the most used substance across all grades, and that we've seen an increase in substance use from the grade to the grade. Island County youth were experimenting with alcohol more than Washington youth. So this is something that was unique. And these years, we've seen an increase in alcohol use. That's a little bit different than most years when we get more concerned about marijuana use or e-cigarettes. That's something that we should be kind of thinking about as we move forward in time. And these questions for substance use are lifetime. So lifetime use, so for example, in the alcohol use, this is have you ever used alcohol in your life? It's not the frequency of use or what we consider binge drinking, it's just that they have tried it. For electronic cigarette use, this is lifetime use as well. So have you ever tried any cigarettes? And we see that it's increasing with age. And it's higher among attempted 12th graders when compared to Washington State. Marijuana use is also increasing with age. So as kiddos become older, they're more likely to be, in this case, to try marijuana. And among 10th and 12th graders in Island County, and the island specifically, they're higher than they want. Mind moving in an okay speed, everyone. This is a lot of numbers, but really the big takeaway here is that when looking at just eighth graders in this slide, there's been an increase in eighth graders reporting that they feel it is wrong for someone that age to use substances. This is a unique, or yeah, I guess unique for this takeaway that I think is really helpful for us and thinking about ways in which we support youth and make positive, healthy decisions. And I just want to note that as we look at further grades, as folks or kiddos get older, kind of that acceptance or feeling that it's not as wrong or people their age to use it increases. So they feel that it's more okay as they get older. But not necessarily significantly. But eighth graders is this point that's really pretty prevalent that they feel it's wrong for them folks their age. Safety and violence behaviors. Between 2021 and 2023, reports of not feeling safe at school increased among our 10th and 12th grade students. So this is a concern. I've noted the trend across the country. So it's not necessarily the ground count, but also a space where we could kind of dig in deeper and see how we can support our youthfulness. So, bullying reports among sixth graders are a particular concern. As you can see here, upwards of 38% of our sixth graders reported being bullied in the past. Some risk and protective factors that we looked at for this presentation. So just for everybody's kind of a brief overview of risk and protective factors, risk factors are characteristics of individuals and their families, school, and communities that make them more vulnerable to ill health. And protective factors exert a positive influence or buffer against the negative influence of those risks in their social environments. for community risk factors, some of the themes that are introduced throughout the survey include availability of substances, laws and norms favorable for substance use in the community, low neighborhood attachment, and availability of guns. So as kind of that trend, we're seeing kiddos using alcohol more often. We look at the ease of access of alcohol in our community, and access to alcohol is increasing with age. But at the same time, I have found it as comparable to Washington State. Community protective factors that are explored in the survey of the opportunities for pro-social community involvement, sports teams and other recreational opportunities, service clubs, activity clubs, and something that's very unique is there is an adult who has been in the community. Some of them that are covered in the survey. Most Island County youth report that they are participating in after-school activities. I know that this was of interest last year as we explored the youth SOAR program and our no program activities for after school engagement. And so I think that this is really valuable for us to celebrate and really look at some of the other opportunities for students across our islands to participate in after school activities. Participation in after schools activities have increased since 2021. Most Island County youth report that they have an adult in their life that they can talk to about something important. This is also something of value for our after school program, the Dino and SOAR programs in particular, in one of the focus areas, making sure that students have somebody that they can send to talk to. And this is not exclusive to just that program, but it's made across all of our schools. And something we celebrate as well, and put me into really as a competitive factor. Some family protective influences and factors include opportunities for pro-social family involvement, that you can discuss problems with your parents or guardians, chances for fun with your parents or guardians, involvement in family decisions, that your parent or guardian talks about not drinking alcohol or using marijuana or other substances, and then their feelings about drinking, smoking, and other substances. Most Island County youth report that they have opportunities to do fun things with their parents or guardians, which is really exciting, something that should also be able to celebrate. Some school risk factors include academic failure and low grades. Grades are worse than most students, so the question really asks students, do you feel like your grades are worse than your peers? Commitment and importance based on school from the perspective of students who completed the survey, and then really just honing in on attendance, absences, and having class, so thinking about self-important. Absenteeism has increased across all grades, and I say this with also the caveat that the survey I'm standing right now doesn't necessarily ask what the reasoning for those absences are. So I think that that is an opportunity for us to dig a little deeper. As shared among many community partners and people that anecdotally have shared information about this, they feel as though there are multiple reasons. May not just because of this, maybe a family trip, but maybe for many of the reasons why it's been in school, but still a concern and something to look into further. Some school protective factors include academic achievement, grades better than most students, and feeling that your grades are better than most students, which is a commitment and importance based on school and then their attendance. But kind of a flip, as you can see, on most of those. So Island County students, 50% of them report that they are often or almost always in the school. An opportunity or maybe a celebration could be both ways. And Island County students report that they try their best in school, often almost all of the students. Often not really good students. I apologize for many numbers on this now that I'm seeing up here, but physical activity and health. So this is a percentage of the self-reported that I recommend of 60 minutes of physical activity. And as you can see, it's quite low. There are also some other people that do. So this has to do with mental health and feeling sad or hopeless. So Island County Youth reported a decrease in feeling sad or hopeless between 2021 and 2023. This was a particular concern for the Board of Health last year because of these findings. And so I wanted to bring it back. And then as you can see in the lighter blue boxes, it says particularly significant. So this is a decrease that's more Island County youth have an adult tendency when they feel sad or hopeless. And you can see that it's because of the significant increase across the age of 10 to 12 years. So we look at a myriad of adverse childhood experiences. It's a quite in-depth, lengthy body of work. So I was trying to best do the chances on the slide, but adverse childhood experiences are indicators of severe stressors that occur during a person's first 8 years of life. These experiences can influence physical, mental, social, and behavioral growth and development across the lifespan. And the key takeaway here is over 50% of the 8th graders in this slide report one or more adverse childhood experiences. So, it's okay, go ahead.
So having worked in the ACEs field for as long as I have, it's important to note that ACEs include going through a divorce. 50% of most kids have been through that. ACEs include frequent moves, and with being on a military installation, that is an eight that leads to ACEs. So I don't want to I want to normalize the data a little bit, that just by nature of the populations that are here, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're in a 50% of our kids are at risk. 50% of our kids are experiencing things that are considered an adverse childhood experience. And, you know, being in a military kid where you moved around a lot, that's one. Being a kid who goes through, those are things. I try to sometimes normalize that. That's different than an adverse childhood experience is also being a victim of trauma or, you know, having a significant health factor or living in poverty. So they're sort of listed as if, but they're not beta weighted as if. And I think that's important when we talk about our community, because our kids are strong and resilient. They just happen to live in a community where things like frequent moves happen.
So with that in mind, there are a few key takeaways from the adverse childhood experiences. This presentation, I should say, also shared with the child with the Neighborhood Health Advisory Board, and so they wanted to make sure that people highlighted about the Board of Health as key takeaways, kind of as Commissioner St. Clair mentioned, looking at specific adverse childhood experiences or specific violence that you say, I'm sorry. So this one is pretty much, I would like to focus more on the middle question, but the access of adults that are physically addictional on purpose and not for the injury. But of course, all of them are of concern as well. So these are things that, as I would say, will come afterwards, challenge review and have some ideas. And that can be a bunch of shared support help. More in a letter, not necessarily just for the sake of time, not necessarily today. But
there's data on this section on date on interpersonal violence between youth, because we had that as a chat factor at one point. Okay.
Yeah.
So sad.
Measuring Open Island County, if you don't know this about me already, I very much love the idea of hope, and I think that it's a huge, tremendous value to the survey, but also something that I would encourage us to continue to look at and find ways to uplift and educate. Hope is the belief that the future can be better in the past, than the past, and oh my gosh, than the past. And we play a role in making it so. Hope is made of both goals, pathways, and agency, and that hope can be possible. So some of the pathway questions that are asked in the HOPE scale, which are included in the Health Equity Survey, include ideas or examples that I think of many ways to get the things in life that are most important to me. And when I have a problem, I can come up with lots of ways to solve it. Agency and willpower, looks at your self-efficacy and motivation to use multiple ways to reach a goal. And some examples include, I am doing just as well as others my kids my age. And I think the things that I've done in the past will help me in the future. So with that said, the majority of our Island County youth report being highly helpful. And I'm happy to, I didn't go into detail as to each of those questions and kind of that breakdown, but that is a possibility for us to continue what elements of hope are the highest or are different among our youth. But really, just a particular year, there's a lot of hope. Despite the things that are happening and in life, the things that we would like to be able to have influence on and improve in our community, there's the foundation of hope that we can build upon. And so I wanted to just kind of close this out a little bit. I did not include information about Dino today, but I'm happy to because I think that's been a fantastic program and SOAR and all of the partners that are involved in that initiative. But I did want to bring a little bit of information about our youth clinical cannabis backward prevention program that we have in public health. Really just honing in on the value of community partnership in this program. We partner with our community coalitions, both in South of the Parish Coalition as well as other youth coalition. We have built partnerships with our local schools through our student assistant professionals. We do education and prevention work in partnership with these folks. And then we have support opportunities and then have an environmental impact that's incorporated into the health care of the YCCEPT, which really focuses on, in our case right now, thinking about signage and just kind of like public notification of where it's okay to partake in smoking activities where it's not okay, and we're just having to be clear about that environment. So these are our partners really through this program. We've been working with our CARES Coalition on social media outreach through our youth and our team as a whole. Our Ocala Youth Coalition really hones in on our student advocacy and support for student voice and their work as well. The Little Lock is our safe storage initiative around safe storage of cannabis in our community to keep it locked up and safe from youth. We also have an example of You Can, it's one of the campaigns that we look at for really honing in on hope and positivity, and you can make the decision to live a healthy life. And that's geared towards youth. Peer to Peer is also a youth-led initiative where kiddos learn how to be there for their peers and support each other and make positive healthy decisions. And then the school discipline system checkup has a lot to do with our right now specifically Coupeville School District, which is just kind of looking at our policies around discipline related to substance use more specifically, but and making sure that we're being equitable and that really aligning the practices, best practices around discipline to promote healthy living and health discipline. All right, that was, thank you for all of that time. So, really like,
Is there any questions of Taylor?
Got two.
Go for it.
Well, it's kind of interesting here. The chart that you have here where, you know, it has the violence experience by Island County youth. You take a look at that one, and then majority of Island County youth reported being highly hopeful. You take those percents, and where we're at 70-some percent on the one, and you take a look at this other one, they go hand in hand. And, you know, the fact that how they're being treated at home or other places, so I really like how you put this together. The other one is that when you're doing the interviews and you're finding out, you know, how many kids are using pot or using, you know, alcohol, the question that you ask is, where do they have access to it? I mean, is it something that they have access because the parents have it at home? You know, I mean, we've got laws now on guns that they have to be in a lock, you know, a box or a cabinet. I mean, alcohol and pot, you know, they get it at home, and each grade level would be different, or do they, you know, buy it, you know, from friends that are over 21 or whatever. It'd be kind of interesting to put that question to them as to how do you get access to it.
Yeah, actually there is, I didn't include it, there is a question about that in the survey. It asks where you are accessing that, whichever substance it is that the question is about. So I'm happy to look into that.
Well, that's something to get out into the community to reinforce the fact that as parents, you have a responsibility to keep those things out of reach of your children. I think that quite a lot of them that do even want to get into a family living cabinet or find a pot around the house. I'd be interested to see that chart.
It's a really good point, Ron, because that would be part of our educational.
Yeah, I mean, how do we go out, right? Like I said, there's laws out there on what do you have to do with a handgun. Mm-hmm. Well, alcohol, all those things, just is about as dangerous anymore. They lead to so many problems. So, like I said, it'd be interesting to see that question.
Any other questions?
It's interesting, when I was raising my children, and one of the factors was what they used to call farming parties, where children would steal pharmaceutical drugs from their parents. And that was a risk factor back. Now my children are all the age of our presenters here. So that tells you a little bit about how old I am. But that was also when we began to implement, speaking of the safe storage laws, when we began to also implement drug take back laws, so that you didn't have drugs, you know, as soon as a prescription was done. And when I had meningitis and I had very, very high dosage, they did not have those drug take back laws. And so I was very concerned about having teenagers around and what to do. So I think some of the laws that have moved us in the direction of public safety have helped reduce risk factors in our youth to some degree. So I appreciated your question, because certainly, as you know, now I'm parenting grandchildren in this age range. I'm not parenting them. Their parents are parenting them. I just get to buy them presents. But I think looking at risk factors and then how do we as a society respond to manage those risk factors is sort of an important part of how we see this. I had a question about, this is not going to surprise you, Taylor. I had a question about data. When we're looking at the lifetime marijuana use and some of the data and the increases between 8th, 10th, and then sometimes we saw a fall off in 12th grade. And I wonder if our high-risk youth that were in the survey in 10th grade are part of that same survey in 12th grade, or if because they've come out, they've left school early, you know, it's the data bias, that if we're seeing less 12th graders or 18-year-olds at risk because they're not in school, but we still have 18-year-olds at risk in our community. They're just no longer in school, and that school engagement. And I remember when, prior to the pandemic, we opened a teen drop-in center across the street from Jack in the Box there in Oak Harbor, not far from the school. And the advantage of things like, what's the program on Camino? Is that SOAR? the Stanley Community School District, the one that the proviso paid for, Linda? What was the, okay. So I think when we have these places where kids can drop in and be safe, but they may not be captured in this data because the good kids tend to get to graduation, having just celebrated two graduations. I worry about our kids who aren't connected to the schools and the risk factors for those youth that may not be reflected here because this they fall out of the data over time. Does that make sense to you?
The school to fill it out.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an opportunity there for us to be think intentionally about how we reach youth who may not be in school anymore, right? Or who aren't there the day that they take the survey, for example. So I think that there's definitely an opportunity there to do a little bit more intentional outreach for folks who aren't captured in the information.
That's why I appreciate the efforts of our human services team and their community and family programs that they're, while I was very supportive of our school-based mental health, those kids have a safety net around them, the kids that are in our schools. We worried about this during the pandemic. I know that my son's a child welfare worker and he really worried about, nobody had eyes on his caseload and his kids during that time. And so our community and youth are seeing kids in community, not necessarily in a safe place where we already know we've got good adults with eyes on those youth, mm-hmm. right? And so I just want to emphasize that this data is really, really important, but let's remember we have kids that may not be included in this data that we need to continue to do outreach and serve.
Thank you.
Really appreciate this fact that you did a good job.
Thank you. I'd also like to do a little shout out. We do have drug take back events twice a year in South Woodby. Happy to expand those as well in the future, but so they happen in April and October. And we are also working, our South Woodby Cares Coalition is working on becoming a mail back location. So in opportunities where you may not be able to or don't want to drop off your medications at, let's say, a Rite Aid, or a pharmacy that's participating or can't make it to the drug take back days, there'll be a mail back option as well in the future. So I definitely echo that from you, Commissioner. I think that that's a really valuable service that we provide for our community.
Did you have something, Captain?
I do, thank you. For those who have base access, our clinic is a mail back facility. So you can get the envelopes inside the pharmacy area and then a mailbox right outside. So
wonderful.
Make that easy. But this is very interesting. Were there, we kind of mentioned the ACEs, but were there any other areas in the data you think the military population may have, you know, confounded, or any findings that you may attribute to that population that's sometimes a bit transient? It might be hard to cohort over time. There's a lot of transient military population.
Yeah. I would say likely with the absenteeism, maybe a challenge for some folks. There are questions about how many times have you moved in the last few years, which may disrupt school for some kiddos. But I think there may be an opportunity to really dig into, let's say, Oak Harbor School District specifically, and have that partnership with the school district to further look into the data and see how that population is particularly and uniquely influenced or impacted by just kind of the society and their life, yeah.
And then I do have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
It really struck me about students not feeling safe at school. It looks like we're not outside of the Washington State findings, but you know, have 19% of students not really safe at school. That seems like it's incredible.
Yeah.
And were there breakout questions? What were they looking for specifically? Or was that just a general question at the top?
There are breakout questions regarding like how, what about safety is kind of being impacted. And I'm happy to look into that further. Because I think, yes, you're absolutely right. That's definitely not just safety in general, but kind of what's sparking that feeling of unsafe.
So the next thing we're going to do is move to our panel discussion with the superintendents, and I think asking them to address why they think kids might not be feeling safe in school is a really pertinent question. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Was Dr. Mokia able to join us?
We don't see Dr. Mokian. She hasn't replied to our emails, so we'll move forward with the folks that are joining us online. I see Superintendent Dwight Lundstrom, Assistant Superintendent Lundstrom, Superintendent Steve King, and incoming Superintendent Sharon Leatherwood.
Wonderful.
So welcome. Thank you all so much for joining us. Can you all hear us all right?
Yep.
Thank you for your patience with us. We appreciate it.
So for this discussion, we'll start by letting both of you make a short introductory statement about your district and about your background, and then we'll move into some specific questions. I'll ask the superintendents to respond, and then I'll open it up to the Board of Health with for each question to respond and engage in some dialogue. So Dwight, do you mind starting us off?
Sure. Dwight Lundstrom, Assistant Superintendent. I've been in Oak Harbor Public Schools for 26 years now. I've been a teacher and a principal and now Assistant Superintendent. So what's the next part of this?
That's great. Thank you. Just a quick introduction and then we'll go on to Superintendent King.
All right. Hello, everyone. Superintendent Steve King. I've been the superintendent in Cookeville Schools for 6 years. I'm actually resigning at the end of this year and moving on to back to the classroom and be a school teacher in Maui with my daughter and grandson. Been an educator in Washington for 27 years. I spent 17 years in the Mount Baker School District, 6 as a teacher and 11 as a principal and at the high school level. And then I spent 4 years as the assistant superintendent in Oak Harbor. And Mr. Lundstrom, I like what you've done with the office. So, and then Shannon Leatherwood is here with us as she's taking over as a superintendent at, in 10 days, not that I'm counting.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. My name is Shannon Leatherwood. I have been a principal for the last 14 years. This is my 27th year in education, and I taught for 13 years. I was also represented the state of Washington as secondary principal of the year last year.
Great. Thank you all for joining us. So our first question, and we could go in that same order if that works. So how has the pandemic influenced the behavioral and mental health needs of students and staff in your district? And what strategies have been effective in addressing these challenges? Heavy hitter.
That was an easy one.
Well,
I think for the first thing that the pandemic did was it made it, we have a lot more attendance problems now. Families seem to be quite willing to be absent from school. We kind of created that habit during the pandemic. Student needs, I think they really got used to being on social media and those things, and we're seeing a lot more press and research about social media coming out about the dangers of it. And we actually in Oak Harbor this year, we through board policy, we set it so that kids may not have cell phones out during class, and that's helped instruction a ton. I think the next move will be like Seattle schools and look at not having cell phones in school at all. But I think it's going to take us a couple of years to get there. So we have a lot of kids with, anxiety seems to be a really high flyer for us right now. I'm not sure why. I think our families got used to being home alone, and then all of a sudden we put them back in schools, and it makes them nervous to be around big groups. So, and then we are actually experiencing, and this is anecdotal, but it's shared by my nurse team to me, is a lot more sexual behavior right now, and it's making us a little nervous. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. So for Cookeville, you know, I pretty much could just say ditto on that. I think one thing I would add, you know, what we've seen here on the secondary campus is we've seen fentanyl popping up a little bit. So with some of our drug use, we're definitely concerned about the fentanyl use. We've seen a little bit on our campus. Everything Mr. Lundstrom said is the same here in Cookeville. I think most districts across the state are experiencing most of the same things. We too have been addressing the cell phone issues in the classroom at the secondary campus, which has been helpful. We don't allow cell phones at all in the middle school during the school day. So students put them in the lockers before the day, and then they get them back out after the school day is over. And then at the high school campus, they don't use cell phones in classes, unless, of course, there's teacher permission for a project or something like that. One thing I would add to what Mr. Lundstrom had to say, and I know the Healthy Youth Survey doesn't address this, but we see a lot more social, emotional, and behavioral issues right now in our elementary and specifically our primary grades post-pandemic. We really see a lot of, I mean, everything from, you know, potty training and all those types of things that just kids aren't nearly as ready for school as they were pre-pandemic. And so we're spending a lot of time just teaching and working on those social, emotional, behavioral issues. I think you asked about staff too. So I'll add there, we're getting a lot more staff absences to add to the student absences. Our staff attendance has gotten way worse after the pandemic. We're spending about twice as much money per year on teachers and staff being absent, and staff are just getting burnt out, and a lot of folks taking early retirement or moving on to other jobs. So that'd be what I would have to add.
Thank you. Shannon, anything in addition?
I could just add a couple things. I'd like to reiterate what both said about just the social media. The access to social media, I think, has caused a lot of the sexual implications that have happened at all levels. We're seeing it down to the elementary all the way up to high school. Behaviorally, we're seeing an increase nationwide with some of the behaviors, because of the trauma that COVID brought on, and also the masks, which also caused the anxiety level to go up in schools. At a national level, they're looking at this as well, but just access to drugs, access to alcohol has caused some of those emotional pieces as well. So, and then just to reiterate what Mr. King also talked about, which was the staff needs. We're seeing a lot more, an increase in mental health needs for staff, as well as those staff absences as well.
Thank you. So I'll turn it over to the Board of Health. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
Sean, real quick, sorry to circle back. You know, I think one thing, and this wasn't necessarily pandemic related, but somewhat, everyone here has talked about social media. You know, I think when you know, smartphones and social media came out, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago, we thought we were connecting people and bringing people together. And what we're seeing is students are now lonelier than ever. And it had this reverse effect. And I would say, you know, we've got this AI thing coming down the pike now. And I'm really concerned, you know, as we keep making progress and adding more technology to our systems, that we just don't know what we don't know yet, and the negative outcomes that may come with all these new things for our population. I'm really concerned about what may be coming next with all of that. So hence, I'm going to Hawaii to be a teacher.
Thank you. Great. I'll turn it over to the board if there are follow-up questions.
Any follow-up?
Can I follow up on the technology question? Yeah. So I've heard parental concerns about technology. You know, we have a wonderful opportunity with technology in our schools and tablets to access information and be able to do that. But I've also heard some concerns about technology in the schools when kids, when I was a little kid and I finished my work, I got to go to the reading center and read a book and do library time, or go to the art center and do art. I've heard that in our schools, kids are able to get rewarded by finishing their work, by getting access to technology in their tablets or their phones. What do you guys know about that? That's just something that's come to me as a concern from parents, is not rewarding our youth with more screen time, but instead diverting them over to creativity or reading or other things. I'm just wondering if you've heard that, since you brought up the issue of technology.
Well, I think it's a frustration for teachers also, because that's where the kids go to. They don't want to read a book. They want to get on their Chromebook and play a game or whatever. quite honestly, we use a program called Linewise for filtering. And so we block game sites, we block a lot of things. We actually capture keystrokes. So if kids are saying things that are harmful, the keystroke capture allows us to see the, either issues of self-harm or issues of harming others, as well as it also allows us to capture proxy sites, because kids are constantly trying to get into sites that they're not supposed to. And so these are things that we never thought we'd be doing in schooling. So we try not to use technology as a reward, but there are parents that very much want us to use it as a reward for when their kids are doing the right things in school. We have families that have used iPads and iPhones to pacify for many, many years. And so that's what kids come to us accustomed to. And I think that's kind of what Mr. King was referring to as far as just some of the issues we're seeing from kids.
Yeah, I'd add for Coopville, I mean, Dwight said it very, very well. We also have our security systems in place. And if there's any inappropriate use of technology, we're alerted and can address that. And most negative things are blocked, so kids can't even get there. You know, I would say a lot of the rewards, as was stated, you know, kids don't see going to read a book somewhere as a reward. But they do see getting time on a device as a reward. And we try to do, when we do use it, in creative ways. Like we have iReady lessons and different lessons that kids can do. And kids enjoy that freedom to kind of enrich their learning. And they happen to be doing it on an iPad or a Chromebook. So, you know, what you're hearing isn't necessarily false, because there are times that is used as a reward. But typically it's done as a positive reward that enhances learning and doesn't have negative outcomes. So we're trying to, you know, with all the new technology that's out there, trying to teach the kids how to use it appropriately and in productive ways and not just take it away from them.
Well, thank you.
Good question.
Thank you for the context on that. As someone who unfortunately probably does more books through Lippy than I do in my hands anymore, I understand the context, but then I'm in my car an hour and a half a day at least.
Yeah. Did you have any follow-up for this question? Okay, Sean?
Yeah, we'll stay on the topic of technology. So the United States Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, recently issued a report on the effects of social media on youth behavioral health and the effects on increasing loneliness. And he made news today by calling for a warning label to be issued for social media platforms. You've talked a bit about, you know, supports and controls that are in place around digital citizenship and online safety. I'd open it up if you have anything additional to add that your districts are pursuing and how we might support as in public health at the community level to support, you know, prevention and education approaches.
Very timely question. Steve, you're going to go first this time?
Well, I sure like it when you go first, because you get all the good stuff out there, but I'm glad to go first. Well, I think, Sean, I appreciate that. The warning label, I mean, better late than never, right? I think it's good that they're finally catching up to it, but we've been seeing it for 10, 15 years. And we've just seen that the escalation of it. You know, I think we've been trying to work with staff. We're working really hard. I think the area that we really need to address is parenting. And we really need to look at our parents as technology immigrants. And they don't know this space as well as their kids are. The kids know the space and the parents don't. And as soon as the parents or the school district kind of gets on to where the kids are, they move to the new platform. So, you know, I go all the way back. I'm old, you know, when MySpace started out and everything else. As soon as we learn MySpace, we're on to Facebook. And then we figure out Facebook, and then they're on to Instagram, and they keep hopping around. So it's really hard to keep up with the kids. because I think they like their privacy and be on their own. And let's face it, our tech industry world is making money off of this. So I think it's a really tough situation, but I think parent training is probably the most critical place. And we do try to have conversations with our parents and provide, you know, I'll send out things to parents once in a while, try to help them. But parents don't like being told how to parent. So I think giving them those resources is good. But, you know, it's difficult to parent in this world right now because parents didn't grow up in this world. So if there's any way public health could help, it would be in educating parents and families how to raise kids in this world of social media and smartphones and now AI that parents have no idea about. You know, and kids are going in their bedrooms at 11 o'clock at night with smartphones or iPads or whatever. And the parents are thinking, oh, they're safe and they're fine. One quote I recently heard from a psychologist was, we are overprotecting our children in the real world and underprotecting them in the digital world. And I think that's kind of where we're at right now. And really kind of summarizes our concerns around the health of our youth.
Thank you.
Yeah, so if you want a good read, read The Anxious Generation and, Coddling of the American Mind. Same author, same topics. I think from a island perspective, I think we need to stress the safety that our kids have when they're rolling around town by themselves, and we need to let them free range a little bit. And what Mr. King was saying is we overprotect them in the community, but not online. We let them go to Mars online is the way the anxious generation, they have access to pornography and all kinds of fun stuff online. And they're sitting right next to you when they're doing that. And we worry about them riding across the street to get an ice cream cone. And our communities are safe. They talk about let grow and giving free play to kids and getting kids in parks without their parents being present all the time, because they don't, our kids don't know how to sort out a disagreement, which is why we see some anxious behavior in school and why we see some of the dysregulation that we see, because they're not getting free time. We guide everything they do, that we sign them up for soccer and youth basketball and peewee baseball. And we're always present as parents, except when we're sitting next to them and they're online. So that's kind of what's going on.
So great minds think alike. I just read the same two books and it's where I got that quote. Yep. I'll add one more. Dwight was, he mentioned in the book and I've looked at it, free range kids or free range children in, there's studies out there now that the more unsupervised play that kids get, the more healthy, the better overall well-being they'll have as they grow up. And I've noticed it doing the snow runs the last several years. When I first started as a principal, every time there was a snow day, the hills would be covered with kids and children sledding and doing all kinds of stuff. But now we're all worried the kids might get hurt, so they're sitting inside on their devices. So that, not sure, you know, that we're giving you a lot of answers, but we're certainly, you know, hopefully sharing with you what the problems are.
Yeah.
But I think as a community, we can work together to ensure families that our kids are safe and figure out ways for them to have kind of supervised but unsupervised play. Give them spaces where they can play, but there's a watchful eye that's non-intervening.
Thank you. I'll open it up to the board.
Any follow-up?
Really good comments.
Yeah. Can I follow up on the Surgeon General report? And it leads to a policy question for you too, because I love policy. So the Surgeon General's report talked about some social media platforms show suicide and self-harm related content, including even live depictions of this. And there's a whole thing in our social media world around this, and I'm not going to get the word, but the right words probably, but this deep fake paradigm where they make up content to make it look real. And I know that kids' social media use is tracked, and that Representative Norma Smith back a few was working on data privacy laws, mm-hmm. which I certainly believe we should be pursuing for our youth. And then perhaps there are some who are saying that we need to figure out a way to eliminate this deep fake media. And, you know, how you feel about it as adults is one thing, but I think to protect our youth, I'm wondering what you guys think about that, both the data privacy work that was started by Representative Norma Smith. Thank you. Why did I just had a blank? She was great to work with. But in this other stuff, we have these incredible risks for our kids right now. And how do we protect them? And is there a role that we as legislative advocates can play in that conversation with our elected officials?
If you figure that, the one element we're missing, we haven't talked about at all, is our girls tend to be in social media. Our boys tend to be on video games and playing in video game groups. And that's where predators and whatnot are getting access to our boys. So there's a little different, there's two different venues that we need to consider. And then if you have the answers to all those questions, you could write a book and run for president.
I just am worried about our youth in this yep. world. I didn't grow up in this world. I got kicked out of the house at 3, you know, in the afternoon and said, come back at dinner. And that was, you know, I am a free range child.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, I'll just add, you know, I would love, policy wise, I would love to see kids not have smartphones until pick an age. I mean, any age would help. I mean, we see kids in kindergarten with smartphones now, but I'd love to see, you know, 14, 16, something like that. You know, I don't know how we did it, but somehow, you know, people my age survived. And same thing, I don't know who said it, but my mom kicked me out after breakfast and said, see you at dinner. And somehow I always made it back. And meanwhile, right now we're so scared to let our kids out of the house without a tracking device and being able to call them every second of the day, and it's doing more harm than good for sure. So I'd love to see some sort of thing with our phone companies or something where kids don't get phones till they're a certain age. Any place would be a good place to start, because right now it's happening really young.
On that topic, Steve, I think there's a good community example with the Pediatric Associates of Whidbey Island. With their patient community, they have a smartphone pledge where they ask parents as a voluntary measure, you know, would you sign on to this pledge and limit smartphone access until a kiddo, I think it's until they're 16, and they provide kind of the evidence for why that's a good health decision to make. So there are some examples of that out in our community that we could look at and build on.
When we're dealing with student truancy issues, when we take them to the community engagement board or take them to court, I would venture to guess 95% of the cases we're dealing with are because kids are locking away in their rooms with a device and either playing games or on social media into the wee hours of the morning. And then their sleep cycle is so off, they can't get up in the morning. And then the parents just give up fighting with them. So it's affecting just them even getting to school and attendance for public school. You have to be there to be successful.
Thank you. So we'll move on to the next question. So what partnerships has your district established with community organizations and providers to support the physical and behavioral health needs of students in your district?
Well, we have two interventionists that we partner with. We have a 50-50 salary split with the ESD, and then we have one mental health counselor at Oak Harbor Intermediate. And then Boys and Big Brothers, Big Sisters partner with us quite a lot and try to find bigs, but there's a shortage of bigs and adult mentors for our kids. which I imagine you've heard that, and they're struggling financially. Just philanthropic groups and nonprofits are having a hard time getting money right now. And then the Navy helps with, they call them MFLACs, Military and Family Life Counselors. Currently we have one at Olympic View Elementary. We have one at North Whidbey. We have one at the high school. And we have one at Oak Harbor Intermediate. I think I might have repeated a school there. But we struggle with those folks staying on, and the Navy struggles with hiring them. We really want to prioritize Crescent Harbor and Olympic View because those are the most impacted students that we have for Navy. You know, you guys were talking about kids that move, and that's a form of ACEs. And so those kids, they deal with moving kind of on every 3-year cycle in their lives. And then they have the deployment cycle to boot. So those are our partnerships. And we do have a Navy liaison that helps us with resources. It's never enough.
Thank you.
Yeah, so to echo here in Coopville, pretty much to scale in all those positions. So we have one MFLAC here in the school district. We have one interventionist. We partner with the Northwest ESD on that. We have a half-time mental health counselor in partnership with the Northwest ESD that's shared with South Whidbey. And our mental health counselor rotates between help at the secondary campus and the elementary campus. And then we have a fairly thriving Big Brothers, Big Sisters program down here in Coopville that we rely on closely. And then we do, through a lot of grant work and grants we've written in the school district, we this past year added a district-wide social worker for the first time in the school district, which has been extremely helpful just kind of in providing wraparound services for our kids and coordinating services both in and out of school for students. And what we found is we really need to coordinate services for families. It's our families often who need the support.
Thank you.
Any follow-up? I have kind of a follow-up because it's sort of associated with what this last question. In the Healthy Youth Survey data that we heard earlier, we heard that a high percentage of kids feel that they're bullied. Mm-hmm. And also a hard percentage of kids don't feel safe in schools. Can you address those two things?
Is it me first again, Steve?
Yeah, I like it. I get good ideas from you.
Well, and we got to get Miss Leatherwood to be involved too. Is she still on?
I think she jumped ship.
Oh, dang it. All right. Well, so the first thing I would say about bullying is often, so I'm the harassment, intimidation, and bullying officer, which does not mean that that's what I do. It's I take the complaints. And so that being said, oftentimes we have families misunderstand what bullying is. And the definition of bullying is actually that it's ongoing and pervasive. And oftentimes we'll have two kids get upset with each other and have an issue on the playground, and a parent will think that's bullying, and that's not bullying. That's just a kid being mean and a disagreement for the day. So bullying is kind of misunderstood, and you can see that I have to refer to the definition at OSPI frequently when I'm talking with families about it. Ongoing issues that make people feel unsafe, quite honestly, are a lot more rare than I think the Healthy Youth Survey reports, just because of the misunderstanding of bullying. But there are kids that feel unsafe, and that's kind of where that anxiety thing came. I like the comment I heard about masks. Kids were used to kind of being behind that mask, and coming out from behind the mask has really changed how they view things. The other thing that we get is somebody will say, you never do anything about it, but we will not have heard about it until they've had enough of it. So, you know, a student might have a disagreement with another student 5 or 6 times before they ever report it. And then they've had it by then, But we follow due process, and so we don't necessarily, if we haven't heard about it until this very first time, they're frustrated with us because they don't think we're addressing it when in fact we are. So I don't know that I answered your question, but I got on my soapbox.
Yeah, I would. I mean, everything Mr. Lundstrom said is true down here as well. We actually haven't. I'm also the harassment, intimidation, and bullying officer here in Coopville. We have not seen an uptick in issues over the years. We really seen that. That's pretty static. I do think Mr. Lundstrom's onto something with this whole anxiety issue and sort of perceived safety issues. And I guess maybe I'd say it this way. I think there's a perception that there's a lot more safety issues going on in our country and our world. But I think in the world we grew up in, if there was a safety issue in some other state or something happened, kid brought a gun to school or something like that, nobody was aware of it. We didn't know any better. All we knew was the world we lived in and we felt safe. And now every time a kid pops their phone open or a parent pops their phone open, they're hearing the bad news and they're hearing, oh my gosh, kids aren't safe in school and we need metal detectors and we need all these things, when in actuality, the kids are pretty doggone safe. Not to say that, you know, bad things can't happen here, but, you know, I've worked on the island. Mr. Lundstrom's worked here a lot longer than I have, but, you know, overall, Whidbey Island's a safe place and a good place to be. So not to say we don't have issues, but I am concerned that, again, some of the technology and anxiety issues are contributing to that, you know, sense of feeling safe at school.
I would like to quote a really smart guy I know. His name is Steve King, and he explained that the thing to understand is when we were kids, when we went home from school, we didn't have to deal with that person anymore. But now with social media, our kids are dealing with somebody they might have a disagreement with 24/7. They're never off. And I thought that was pretty insightful by Steve. And I've repeated that many times because our kids never get a break if they are having any kind of disagreement with someone.
You remember that one. That's good.
That's a good one, Steve.
Well, we actually, you know, the other, thanks, Dwight. The other thing to add to that, you know, the era we grew up in, it was called a bathroom wall. And if somebody wrote something bad about you, it lasted a few hours until the custodian cleaned it up and it was gone. And now it goes on a, you know, digital platform and it's there forever. So it's a different world our kids are living in. So.
Thank you. Any follow up?
Okay. Any follow up? Anyone? Janet?
Okay. Thank you. So we know that there's been some changes in the landscape of funding for our school districts as we, you know, have emerged from the COVID-19 emergency situation. And Superintendent King, you mentioned that nonprofits maybe are struggling financially, or, you know, there's changes in military staffing to support behavioral health needs. But can you share how funding changes related to changing COVID-19 pandemic resources or other funding streams have impacted your ability to implement effective programs and interventions for behavioral and physical health? Or not, if it's been an issue.
Maybe I'll take a stab first, Dwight, on this
one. That would be good.
All right. Well, this might be my turn to get on my soapbox. First of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it. So up until the pandemic, we had county-provided school-based mental health counselors. And as soon as the pandemic hit and schools closed, those were taken away and I think reallocated to other areas of concern, which certainly was understandable at the time. Unfortunately, as schools renewed and came back in session, those school-based mental health counselors haven't come back. So we've had to figure out other ways to fill that gap. I would add to that everything we've talked about here today, what we're trying to tell you is our health issues, and especially our mental health issues in our schools, are worse than ever. And we need more support now, not less support. So I wanted to start by mentioning that, that that's been a huge loss. I think the other piece, you know, during the pandemic, the ESSER funds came in, which was sort of a blessing and a curse. The blessing was that it provided for some at least temporary opportunities to help our kids through the and our staff through the pandemic. Unfortunately, all of that has sunsetted this year. And I think what our society didn't realize is that our, I don't know, call it 2 years or 3 years of pandemic interventions, whether it's masks or isolating kids at home or whatever, that's going to have years and years of consequences that it seems like nobody's stepping up to address. I think our state and our nation have just kind of moved on to other issues and decided that there's other important things in the world, and yet our kids are paying the costs of what we did during the pandemic. So those ESSER funds were great for the time. I think they allowed us to bring on some extra staffing. We did some things with it to provide extra supports for our kids, but those things are gone now, and yet the kids are still paying the consequences. So those would be some things I would say. I don't want to get too much into state and school funding because that would be another 2.5 hour meeting, Sean, that I don't think you guys have time for. But, you know, that's an age old problem of schools being underfunded. But those are a couple of things I wanted to highlight was the ESSER funds that were only temporary. And in my opinion, should be about 10 to 15 years, which I think is how long it's going to take for us to get over the consequences of the pandemic. And then we really need those school-based mental health counselors back because it was really unfortunate that they were taken away right at the time our kids need it most. So that's what I'd have to say.
Thank you.
I think you're also seeing higher poverty within our own communities, and that has a big effect on kids. I'll use an example. We are partnered with Oak Harbor Rotary Club, and they provide, they call them backpacks for kids, but they're actually a brown paper bag full of food for the weekend to try to tide our kids over. And we started, I'm in Rotary and serve the schools. So we, our Rotary Club, we started this year with, I think about 112 or 150 bags, maybe. I think about 150. I'm going off memory here, so bear with me. But we are finishing the school year serving about 212 kids. So the backpack program has grown significantly, and the Rotary serves the five elementaries. I think we have a church in town that works with Oak Harbor Intermediate, so I don't know what their numbers are, but we're just seeing a need within our community of people that are just struggling financially and needing food assistance. And that has an effect on our kids and their learning abilities.
Thank you. I know during the pandemic, there was a shift into the community-based mental health program to meet the high community need that was out there. And that Human Services Director Linda Austin here, but I don't know if the board has any response to Steve or Dwight.
Any comments? No, it's sad.
Well, our USDA Western Washington State Director happened to have been a prior county commissioner, and there is some amazing programs through USDA for summer for kids and nutrition, including the SUN program that kids during the school year or on summers. I'm a huge fan of school backpack programs. I used to run food bank programs in my prior life. And I think it's important that we make sure folks like you talk about how important those programs are for our families and youth, and making sure that kids can't come to school ready to learn if they're hungry. And so those kinds of programs, I encourage anyone listening to let former Commissioner Price Johnson know, because she can take that message back to DC of how important those programs are to us.
And I appreciate the comments about the school-based mental health counselors, and I would encourage our human services group to at least let's talk about it during budget and see, you know,
I don't know if you had a chance to listen in to us earlier. We were talking about it's one thing when our kids are in the schools and we know you guys care and the teachers are so amazing and have eyes. Part of what we recognize is how many kids, as you noted, are not in school. And so some of what we've responded to in our community-based child and family program is making sure we have eyes and resources available to those children and youth who are not in school. You are absolutely right. I loved our school-based program. I thought it was powerful, but we're trying to balance all of that out and making sure that as kids don't have loving and caring and responsible eyes on them like you are for your kids, that we have resources in the community for them as well.
Well, I want to be mindful of time. We've reached kind of about 45 minutes of dialogue, and I want to thank you both for making time to attend. I think we've received a lot of really valuable feedback that we can, consider with program and policy development. I'll turn it over to you both if you have any closing comments to make.
No, thank you for the opportunity to be involved and share. And we all have tough jobs to do and limited resources. So thank you for the work you do, because Steve and I get a paycheck out of this deal. You guys are elected.
Yeah.
Yeah. What Dwight said, ditto. I would add to this will probably be the last time I meet with you all. And I wanted to thank Island County Public Health. I've, 10 years here on Whidbey Island, and always had a positive relationship and appreciated the support, especially during the pandemic, but before that and after that. And anyway, I appreciate the partnership, and thank you for your time today and taking these issues seriously and listening to two old administrators, maybe now and then on our soapboxes, but hopefully paint a picture for you of what's going on in our school districts.
Well, I really want to thank you both for your really, really interesting comments. I took lots of notes. It was really very valuable, very interesting. Thank you. And aloha, Mr. Steve. Have a wonderful, wonderful time.
Yeah, aloha. Mahalo.
I'm thinking, you jerk.
I've all of a sudden lots of people are all of a sudden becoming my friends, looking forward to visiting me, and I kind of keep asking, now what's your name, who are you? So, we're looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you both again so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So the next item on our agenda is extreme heat and wildfire smoke readiness.
I'll invite Department of Emergency Management Director Eric Brooks to join this.
Afternoon.
Oh, there it goes. So we know that extreme heat and wildfire smoke are emerging health risks, particularly for older adults, pregnant mothers, infants, and people with chronic conditions. So by working together, we can prepare for extreme heat and wildfire smoke and protect at-risk community members. We can prepare by sharing consistent messaging and health education resources, distributing home health items like HEPA filters and air conditioning units, and planning cooling centers and clean air facilities, and having a check-in process either by phone or in person for at-risk vulnerable community members during a hazard event. So this shows temps around the 2021 June heat dome event, where it reached around 108 degrees on Whidbey. We tend to stay a little bit cooler because of the sound, but we know also during this time, we had a huge increase in heat-related injury visits to the local emergency department. Since 2010, summers have been consistently warmer in Island County, so we see that reflected in our temperature data. And when we look ahead at modeling data, we see warmer temperatures for Island County in the years ahead, even at lower emission scenarios. When we look at air quality data, we see an intermittent risk of unhealthy air due to wildfire smoke. This is looking at the Oak Harbor reference station. And so we saw, in particular in 2018 and 2020, bordering into the, you know, unhealthy, very unhealthy ranges. And then over the past few years, we've had moderate air quality hazards. When we think about community members who are most at risk, we know that our elderly community, and in particular, our homebound seniors are at risk. Infants, pregnant mothers, children with asthma are at risk for air quality hazard events, and people with cardiopulmonary disease like COPD are at risk both for heat and for wildfire smoke. For home health infrastructure, about 30% of Washington's nearly 3 million households use central AC and 25% use individual or room-based units. This is according to a 2020 residential energy consumption survey. So about half of Washingtonians are set up with air conditioning. We don't have county level data on this. In 2023, if you recall, we worked with the University of Washington on a climate equity project, and they interviewed community members in the Latino community. They found a need for air conditioning units and HEPA filters among our lower income Latino community members.
May I ask a question?
Sure. Yep.
So we talk about AC units, but we also know that heat pumps modulate air. Yeah. And I wonder how you talk about that, because I know there's a program at Commerce for low-income households to get access to heat pumps.
Yeah, heat pumps are a great option, and that was considered as an AC unit. And
okay,
when
so they were included in the idea.
Exactly. And in the statewide data, they're okay. Considered a cooling solution. Extreme heat has a range of health impacts. It can cause dizziness and confusion, dehydration, headache, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke, cardiovascular disease. Wildfire smoke can cause sore throat, headache, burning eyes, wheezing, coughing, and cardiovascular disease exacerbations, and up to kind of emergency situations and respiratory distress. Wildfire smoke is dangerous because it contains carbon monoxide, hazardous air pollutants, and particle pollution. And in particular, the most dangerous aspect of wildfire smoke is particle pollution that's under, it's called PM2.5. It's under 2.5 microns in diameter, and it might be a mix of metals or organic compounds. PM2.5 can really infiltrate deep into the lungs and cause a range of health effects. It's very small. So when we think about planning ahead and working with community partners, this work is underway, and we're working with senior services, community centers, our municipalities, NAS, healthcare, our libraries, STEPS, state agencies, ICOM 911, emergency medical services, community health workers, recreation districts, school districts, and the Northwest Clean Air Agency and Puget Sound Energy. I would also add here childcare and long-term care facilities. Yeah, so.
And Snohomish PUD.
And Snohomish PUD, thank you. So there are a range of partners to coordinate with, and that coordination work is underway. So we want to coordinate to share consistent messaging, share forecasts related to extreme heat risks, and share the Washington Smoke Blog, which provides forecasts on air quality, share health messaging, the importance of hydration in a heat event, shading, using sunscreen, never leaving kids or pets in a hot car. I mean, even a car at 70 degrees, it can quickly rise to well above 100. Sharing our cooling center locations. There's a correction here. The Southwood B. Bayview Senior Center is actually not set up as a cooling center, but DEM maintains on their website a list of current cooling shelters.
Who does?
A Department of Emergency
Management. Oh, DEM.
Yep. And for wildfire smoke, we want to, you know, again, share the Washington smoke blog and local alerts. Advise folks during an event to stay indoors with the windows closed and keep pets indoors. And this work can conflict with advice around heat, because if folks don't have AC, that can present a potentially hazardous situation. So that's something we need to navigate. When using air conditioning or heat pumps to stay cool, we want to make sure the outdoor air intake is closed and the filter is clean, and use HEPA filters to clean indoor air, in particular during an air quality event. Adults can use an N95 mask if they need to go out during an unhealthy or hazardous air event, but that's not safe for kiddos and may not be safe for certain folks with chronic disease. And so we're working on sharing resources with EMS, with our healthcare provider community, including health education materials and provider education. And we're sharing these resources with our own teams in human services and public health who are working with at-risk and vulnerable populations. We're distributing air filters to childcare facilities and to directly to families who need those resources. Last year, we distributed a number of box fan filters, which are a DIY type HEPA filter, and very low cost. We received a huge amount of supplies from North Sound Accountable Communities of Health. We also received HEPA filters from the Department of Health that we distributed. This year, we're re-upping by sending out air filters to replace the filters from last year and getting filters out for folks who have not, who need those still. And then we're working with community partners, actually going back to this slide here. We're also working with Opportunity Council of Island County and the WIDBI Essential Needs Program. So when folks do need AC units and there's a financial or income barrier, now's the time to get those in place. And we've worked with Melissa Fresh Brown, who's Director of Opportunity Council, and she's confirmed that Camino residents can also call into that and get that support.
I didn't know HENS paid for these kinds of things.
Right. I think she said it, and it depends on the individual situation, but it can support.
Oh, interesting.
And then we're working with our partners in child care centers. Well, actually, no, we're working in long-term care facilities. Our partners at Island Senior Resources, the community centers, to implement a phone check-in process during a hazard event. So if we get a heat dome, we really want at least a daily phone call. We've developed a phone script and a letter that will go out to partners. You know, these are the symptoms to check in on. And we're working with ISR to think about using the Meals on Wheels program, because they're already visiting homebound seniors. And so they can do an in-person check during a hazard event. And Eric has shared that, you know, if we need additional resources, we can potentially activate volunteers. And then in public health, we think a lot about youth activity guidelines. The State Department of Health developed activity guidelines based on the Air Quality Index. And we're looking at sharing those out locally as a set of recommendations with our recreation districts and camps and other community partners who might be facilitating, so that they know what may or may not be safe, you know, if we have a hazardous air quality event well in advance, and then we can communicate in real time as an event is taking place. So to recap, we know extreme heat and wildfire smoke are emerging risks for vulnerable community members. Through proactive planning, we can prevent adverse health impacts, reduce emergency visits, and protect vulnerable community members. So open it up to questions.
Any questions of Sean?
Along with the Island Senior Resource, will they be able to, you know, take masks with them so that if they are going out and visiting the seniors, that like they have to check their mail or whatever, that they can give them a mask while they're there?
That's a great idea. Yeah, we're thinking they're planning to go out. We're developing some educational materials. We pulled down some from state partners, but we're working on making them they're locally relevant. So we were going to have Meals on Wheels take out, health information, and we could also have them take out N95 masks. We still have a number of masks from, COVID-19.
Any other questions? I think that, you know, it's easy for us today because, you know, it's been cool weather here. But if you watch the news, you see it's just like heat explosion all over the rest of the country.
Yeah.
It's not going to stay cool here for the entirety of the summer.
Right.
Yeah.
It's devastating.
Yeah, we're having our state hospital meeting in Chelan.
Good luck.
Oh.
Yeah, at the end of this month. Where the fires are at.
Oh, golly.
The masks to take.
And there's 0% campaign gone.
I know.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
So the hope is we don't have an event, but we want to do this coordination and planning work now. So we have a process in place.
Really grateful for you for that proactive measure. Good.
As you're pushing out your public health messaging, can you push out? I know there's the Northwest Clean Air has the purple air sensors and the air quality so that people know where to go to check on air quality. Because our weird microclimate means that what may be fine in Oak Harbor may not be fine down by Langley or vice versa. Right. And South Camino's covered by the Langley purple air sensor. And, you know, if you could push out where people can go to get that information about air quality, particularly as they're looking at, should I take my kids camping this weekend or whatever the situation might be.
I think we talked about a situational awareness dashboard that we can talk about in the front. And I think that would be good to add to that.
Yeah, good idea.
That's a great point to think about. It can be very different in one part of the county versus another. We in Northwest Clean Air does a great job of sharing that information out. We do see a need to have a little bit more finer detail around our air quality index information. So we're looking at potentially purchasing some low-cost sensors to have at child care centers and long-term care facilities where we could provide a little bit more specific information to as well.
When your situational awareness dashboard is done, please let us all know so we can.
Oh, so yeah, we'll do a presentation.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Any other discussion on that topic, or we can move our finance.
Thanks, update. Eric.
Thanks. So. Did our last item, so we'll end on time today. For our finance update.
They told me to bring out that new file.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks. So there's a grant tracking kind of key information handout that accompanies these slides. The pictures are there, it's just there to orient. So we have a consolidated contract. We had an amendment number 19 come through, which increased allocations by 238,000 for a pollution identification and control program. This is focused, really the outcome, the goal of this funding is to reopen shellfish harvesting for recreational shellfish in particular sites. It includes Maple Grove, Maxwellton, and Holmes Harbor. The county ran a pollution identification and control program for many years. It helps us really pinpoint where we're having non-point source pollution and hone in on, you know, community messaging and outreach activities to help correct that issue. It will help us develop a comprehensive approach to surface water quality management. So a lot of this work will rest within our Division of Natural Resources team and also within our environmental health department. So we're really excited about this funding and revisiting this work that paused during the pandemic. And any questions about PIC, and then I'll move on to the next item.
Yep.
So next item, the consolidated contract amendment 19 also included funding for our annual WIC farmers market nutrition program. So we provide food vouchers for families for local markets. We're actually running the program currently, and we've been distributing vouchers. And so this, you know, not only supports local families, but it also supports our local growers. And it's a great program. Staff get out there to the markets and have a booth, and it's something we've run for many years, and we're excited to keep providing it. And then this next item is actually we're looking at renewing an agreement with our social media and communications consultant. We've been working with Blueprint agencies for using foundational public health services funding that's allocated specifically for communications. Part of that funding supports the county communications manager, and part of that funding supports this work with a consultant. They develop our, you know, Facebook messaging, our next door messaging. They help with infographics. They recently helped us with launching a new newsletter for our targeting our food industry. And we've really had a positive working relationship with this consultant, and we'd like to continue. And it's, you know, it's supporting not only public health, but also our human services department.
So this new newsletter targeting our food industry, where would people be able to see that?
Yeah, so we shared it out on Nextdoor and Facebook, and it's up on our website. And we also developed a listserv out to, you know, our food establishments directly. It is a little bit more technical. It's really targeting, restaurant owners,
sure,
farmers markets and folks like that. But I think there's still useful information for the public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up on our Facebook page now. And then we have our renewal with Healthcare Authority, contract K7477. This is access to baby and child dentistry, or ABCD. And so this was expected funding to continue the ABCD program, which includes outreach and care coordination to improve early childhood dental health. And we've shifted that program to be integrated with our community health worker program and maternal child health work. And so the program is being led by staff member Daisy Mayer, who presented to the board a few months back. And so we're really emphasizing, you know, a culturally affirmative approach to this care coordination work.
He has four teeth.
Yes, sweet little baby.
Oh, the teeth are on the way. And last, we had our Island County LEBN 2325. This is a contract with the Washington State Recreation and Conservation Office. This is previously budgeted funding for fiscal year 2025. This supports our lead entity coordinator, who's Clea Barenberg, and all her work coordinating local projects, coordinating the citizens advisory and technical committees. So there's a lot of project coordination. It adds $86,852. And this is one of the program's educational tools. It shows where we have where we have salmon habitat, inland around Kameno and North Whidbey. But it's a great program. So that's all we have around our finance update. Any questions?
Has Clea taught you how to know your five types of salmon yet?
She has not me.
Pinky, ring finger for king. I'm going to get this wrong. I'll get to chum for thumb and not remember which one is Chinook and which one is. Now I've already forgotten.
Now that you mentioned that, I have seen her counting on her hands at an outreach event, but I didn't know.
Yes,
pinky, the purpose.
Finger, pink salmon, thumb is the chum.
There you go.
Do we need to approve this?
It's informational. It's just to, you know, keep the board informed of funding that's passing through.
Okay.
And I'll open it up if there are any comments or feedback.
Any comments or questions from Sean? Yeah,
it was a great meeting, Sean. Thank you.
It was. Thank you very much. So the next regular session of the Island County Board of Health will be held on July 16th, 2024 at 1 p.m. here in the Commissioner's Hearing Room, B102 in the Coopville Annex Building. Is there any other comments or questions of the board? If not, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Great meeting.
Thank you.